The nice part of that, what we realized about 10 deals in, that with land, we don't have to go see the properties. We don't have to go re-estimate repairs. We don't have to let somebody into the door of us. We don't have to have boots on the grounds. We don't have to go speak to city inspectors. We can do the research online, and we can do these deals even with my job schedule. I basically, from 11 o'clock at night to 1 a.m., I started looking for deals.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jack Bosch. Now, Jack went from just having two suitcases, nearly an empty bank account, a big dream to be a multi-million land flipping business and to truly live the American success story. He has flipped over 5,000 properties. From their experience, they've created the Forever Cashflow model, which has helped over 1,000 people become millionaires through free and paid educational programs. I'm really excited to have him on the show. It's an understatement, but enough out of me. Let's get him out here. G'day, Jack. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
I'm doing great, Reid. How are you doing?
Can you rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid?
The first dollar as a kid? I don't think I made any money as a kid. I think I'm a late bloomer in entrepreneurship. I'm not one of these stories that did whatever, like sold eggs from neighbor to from door to door. I was like this little bit more, well, I like to party, right, when I was older. But in my early teenage years and things like, I was just reading books and being more quiet and things like that. So just overall a late bloomer. And I really, the first money I made, if I can recall it, was getting a job at the liquor store, which drinking is legal in Germany at age 16 already. So I think by age 18, I got my first job doing this part-time and putting cases of beer in there in people's trucks and delivering to restaurants and stuff like that. And that's, to my recollection, that's the first money I made by working myself.
That's awesome. Walk us through the story of early Jack in Germany. You know, did you have a career before becoming an entrepreneur? You mentioned that you're a late bloomer. So what did that journey look like?
My dad's a high school teacher. School system's a little different. He taught 5th to 10th grade. And my mom's a stay-at-home mom. Nobody in my entire family has a history of being an entrepreneur. My brother actually became one just a couple of years before I became one. But that's the only reference point. That's the only other entrepreneur we have in a family. And on neither side of the family, anyone started their own business. So I only had one model to follow. And that model was, you go to school, then you go to the upper school. In Germany, they have a weird system that they kind of like position you into like either like a simpler school, a middle school, or like a more advanced school. And I got to the more advanced school, and then I finished my degree there. And then it was a clear path to university because my dad was the first one in our entire extended family to go to college. So my brother was the second one. I'm the third one. And through that, I studied business, and the career plan was very clear. Go get the degree. Go get a job in Germany, perhaps in consulting or something like that. Work your way up and build that career in corporate Germany in that case. That went sideways when I came to the US, and basically just for 1 year, actually the year to come to the US was part of the career, because I realized if I wanted to be, I worked part-time as a college student in Germany at a software company, and they started having an office in India. And they're starting bringing people from India in, and I've started having to communicate in English with people. And I realized just how bad my English was at the time. And so I realized I got to do something about it. It was school English. It was okay. It was conversational, but not good enough to make a career. And if you want to do a career in corporate America or corporate Germany, I realized I needed to improve my English. So I had the chance to actually do an exchange program with a university in Germany, in the United States, with one of their partner universities in the U.S., and I did that with a simple goal of just improving my English. And as a side note, I got an American degree by doing that. So it's like, great, I get an American degree. I show my flexibility in the job market. I improve my English. Hey, it's three wins in 1 year. Let's do it. Well, little did I know that 3 weeks into it, I come across this beautiful, young, smart lady that now is my wife for 23 years. And as a result, We decided to stay in the US, get into corporate America now, and realized two years into it that I absolutely hated it and we wanted to break out. And that's the short story of like how I even considered entrepreneurship.
That's awesome. It's such a so refreshing hearing these coming to America stories. I love them. I obviously experienced it. I did my own story, but we've all got one. And it's so refreshing. I love it. So tell me about the story into the big thing behind you, the big banner, the Land Profits. And we've spoken a little bit about Land Profits on this show. I can't actually remember the last time we spoke to someone about it, but maybe you can break it down into how you discovered this as an investing niche and then now how you go out and educate others to do what you do.
So it came out of failure, really, because we're in this corporate job and we realized after 2 years that this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life, or 2.5 years. There was like sets of layoffs that are happening, and I was faced with that for the first time. I didn't lose my job, but I saw how stressful it can be to work in a company when there's layoffs left and right. And I really didn't want to be in that, in a career path. Like that dream of corporate America, corporate Germany, of doing a career kind of like poof, because I saw that I would have to be faced with a potential loss of job probably every 3 to 5 years as the companies goes to the up and down of a life cycle of a company. And I was like, that's not what I want to do. I need to have control of my own life. So we determined, consciously say we, because we're a team, Michelle and I, we determined that we needed to break out of that. We needed to do something else, but we had no clue what to do. So we looked at all kinds of different things, business models, what to do, ran any kind of business through a set of criteria that we developed. And ultimately, we came across real estate. And we liked it because you can make money with real estate, a lot of money. You can do it in a way that you don't have to be in the business every single day and do something about it every single day, like in a job or in a, I don't know, a restaurant. If you're the chef, you have to cook every day. If you don't cook, nobody eats, right? And you can create passive income. And also if you pick the right niche, you can do it part-time and from a distance. So we just didn't know what niche to pick. So we started with what everyone tells you. We started with wholesaling houses. So we did driving for dollars. We drove around. We found some boarded up houses, contacted the owners. And guess what? We actually got a deal on a contract, but we didn't have a clue how to estimate these repairs. So we did everything wrong because we were complete newbies, got the wrong price, marked it up by $5,000, tried to sell it, got a lot of inquiries. Nobody wanted to buy the property. And so we freaked out and backed out of the deal. Then we went to the next thing, which we came across was like tax liens and tax deeds. The fact that people don't pay property taxes in some cases on the US. And as a matter of fact, there's over $5 billion worth of real estate that every year goes through tax auctions where the owners haven't paid property taxes. So that blew our mind that there's indeed people that either don't care or whatever reason, they just don't pay the property taxes. So we started going there. We started attending auctions and we were outbid left and right. So we failed again. We started buying tax liens, and if you buy the lien, you have to usually wait a while and then you can foreclose on the deal. And every lien we bought was redeemed. So the owners ended up paying the property taxes after like a few weeks or a few months. And we made like, I was like to joke, $3.82 with that. And I was like, well, that's not the way to make money. And so soon enough, we kind of like ran after brick wall after brick wall after brick wall. Like fix and flip wasn't for us. We put like some old historic house under contract that was like all termite eaten and we didn't know what to do. And we tried to partner with somebody and they all said no. So again, we're like, okay, we don't know what to do here. So we just failed. And over about a two and a half year period, we just kept failing. But we basically kept saying, there's got to be something in the real estate space that we can figure out. And then we came across the thought, particularly around the tax lien and tax deed world. And the thought was, well, wait a second. If somebody's auction, let's look at California. In California, if somebody, there's tax auctions coming up next month, probably in some of the counties. Usually like in March, April, San Diego, LA County, and so on, they have that tax auction. So there's a tax auction. There's 300 properties that come up for sale. But when did these people actually stop making property tax payments? And the reality is that if somebody's property comes up in 2024 for auction, they stop paying property taxes in 2018. Mm. Or in other words, if somebody decides today that they don't want their property anymore, and they stop paying property taxes today in California, Their property doesn't even come up for auction until the year 2030. So we actually thought, we had the thought, it's like, well, if there's people whose property come up for auction today and they stop paying property taxes 6 years ago, well, then how about, and this is 300 of them, there's got to be another 300 that are 5 years delinquent, another 300 or 500 that are 4 years delinquent, another 500-600 that are 3 years delinquent, and so on. And nobody's contacting these people, but somehow these people have made up their mind that they don't want their properties anymore. So what if instead of attending these auctions, we actually figure out who these people are and we send them a letter? Shouldn't they be, at least on paper, like in theory, shouldn't, if they truly made up their mind that they don't want these properties anymore, shouldn't they be willing to give these properties up for pennies on the dollar? So we went to work. So we contacted the county. And back then, there was no data, there's not online data sources that had any kind of like that information. Tax delinquent information was not available to anyone of the commercial data sources that anyone gets access to today. So we actually had to contact the county. We had to drive down to the county. We had to speak to the, we had to find the IT guy in the county office. And it can tell the IT guy that what we want is a list of everyone who hasn't paid property taxes. And they're like, okay, I can do that. And then we had to get authorizations from the different county officials and a bunch of forms and bring it back. And once they approved it, then we would pay them like $200 and we get a CD. Or in some cases, San Diego County gave us an actual cassette tape, like a tape of that sales that wouldn't fit anywhere. And then we had to find another service that would actually go and process that thing for us and extract it from us and send it to us. And finally, we had this list that had like 1,000 people that hadn't paid their property taxes. So we're like, okay, we got the list. So now we with their names, with their mailing address and so on, because that's public information. It wasn't easy to get to. Today, it's on your fingertips. You pay like 6 cents a record and you can get them in a matter of seconds. So then the next step was we're like, okay, well, let's test our hypothesis. Let's send out 1,000 letters. So we send out 1,000 letters. And what happens is, or actually the first time, I think we only sent out 300 letters to San Diego County, and we get like 6 phone calls back. And those 6 phone calls all own land. Not a single homeowner calls us back. Only landowners. So we're like, what do we do now with these people? So it's like, well, let's be really careful. Like one of them was a lot about outside, was a piece of land in California. And we got that deal under contract for something like $100. We just offered them $100. And we got it under contract and then basically marketed it and sold it for $7,000. Made $7,000 on this deal. It was like, okay, well, that worked. Then we basically started going, okay, well, how about we do this in Arizona? We went to Arizona and we found a similar list and sent out letters. And I got another deal for $400, sold it for $4,000, another deal for $500, sold it for $10,000. And I might get the sequence ready. Might have started in Arizona and then went to California. I don't even remember. It's 20-something years ago. But the bottom line is this started to work. And we started to do, I think in the first year, while still having a job, did 63 deals and made like something like $500,000 or something like that. And we're like, okay, in that moment also our green card, our permanent residency arrived. And we were actually free to quit our job at that moment. But the nice part of that, what we realized about 10 deals in, that with land, we don't have to go see the properties. We don't have to go re-estimate repairs. We don't have to go talk to, let somebody into the door of us. We don't have to have boots on the grounds. We don't have to go speak to city inspectors. We can do the research online through back then MapQuest. Now, obviously, Google Maps, Google Street View, Google Earth, those kind of things. And we can do these deals even with my job schedule, which was 100% travel job schedule. I would jump on a plane Friday, Monday mornings, fly somewhere, sit in some computer room for like 16 hours a day, go to a hotel room at 10, 11 o'clock at night. And if I just like basically, because we're so eager to get out of that job, I basically from 11 o'clock at night to 1 a.m., I started looking at for deals. I started looking at sourcing lists. I started emailing county officials to get those deals. Or once we had deal under contract, I started working on the marketing for it and things like that. So basically on the weekends, we would drive and look at some of these properties. So we basically worked it around our schedule. And the beauty of the thing was I didn't need contractors on there. I didn't hit to sit down with people at their kitchen table. It was all possible to do 100% remotely. And that was the ticket to freedom for us.
That's an incredible story. Thank you for sharing that with us. Now bringing it to the present, what are you doing now? And are the same juicy deals available, the same tactics you used 20-odd years ago, are they still being deployed today?
Yes, they are, 100%. But obviously, a couple of things have changed. Number one, very quickly, we realized that we were running out of tax delinquent properties to go after. Because most counties don't have 10,000 tax delinquent properties. They might have 500. And of the 500, you end up getting five deals. Great, because majority is houses or commercial. They don't respond as easy. But the land deals, there might only be like 50 land deals in there. And if you get 5 or 10 of them, then you're done. And then the auction comes and they're sold and so on. So we realized very quickly that we're running up against a wall. But then we also realized that actually there is 50 times more deals out there where people actually still pay their property taxes, but they're like grudgingly paying them. They're basically like, oh my God, there's the property tax bill again. I don't want to pay this. I've already paid for it for the last 25 years. I'm never going to do anything with that land. I don't want to do it. My kids don't want it, but I don't want to let it go for nothing. Let me just pay the property taxes one more time because it's only a few $100. Let me hold on to that deal one more year. I'll do something with it next year. And they'll never do anything with it. So I started realizing that again and again, and we started realizing that those people would also respond to our letters, and you just have to pay them a little bit more than the other ones, because the typical tax delinquent property, we would pick up between like 10 and 30 cents on a dollar. The typical not tax delinquent property, we would pick up for somewhere between 15 and 45 cents on a dollar. So as a combination, we basically pick them up between 10 and 45 cents on a dollar, but doesn't really matter which ones you go after. That's the one thing has changed. So it opened up what we can do. It opened up the entire volume of deals that we can go after. Second kind of thing that changed is that nowadays, today, is technology. The lists are now available at public record. You can go to DataTree, CoreLogic, all these different places online, and you can download tax delinquent data. Like, it's now, every source has it. It's an easy to get kind of record. Land data. None of these services, you'd have any land data because nobody would go after land. Now there's enough people doing this that land data is available. But enough doesn't mean that there's a lot of competition. Just means that it's gotten popular enough, probably because we're the first ones teaching this. We're the one that's generated the most millionaires in the country or in the world with land flipping. So now we actually reached out to all these services. They're like, can you add land to your offering? And they're like, well, do you have anyone that wants it? It's like, yeah, we got a few hundred students here that are trying to get land data, and they're having a really hard time. And it's like, well, we have it. Let me make it available. So then now these services offer land data, and even like the websites where you sell the properties. We had to put like ads into physical newspapers to sell the land. And people would call us, and we would have to send them a marketing package. And then they would call us back and say, like, I want the land. Now you put Facebook Marketplace, Zillow, land.com, all these different websites that are available that you can simply put your properties up there, which really means now that you can do this from anywhere in the world in the United States. So even if like your fellow countryman in Australia, we actually have students in Australia, like Alicia and Matt, they're doing something like 200 deals a year from Melbourne in the United States. So it works from anywhere in the world in the United States. And why in the United States? Again, because the data from a privacy point of view, the data of who owns the property, when did they buy it, what do they pay for it, what's their mailing address, what's it zoned for, are they owning property taxes, all this information is publicly available for purchase in the United States, and it costs like 5-6 cents a record.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I'm actually part of a land fund, Toro Land Fund. Personally, I've invested about $250,000 into that, and it's a little bit different to what you guys are doing. It's more buying the pizza and selling the slices. So in a rural settings, you go and do a plat map and you can just sell off, you know, you buy 200 acres and you do, you know, 10, 20 acre parcels, maybe put in a common road. That's it, you know, and you can go get some really great ROIs on that. And that's been, you know, within sort of 70 miles of major MSAs in around Texas and Oklahoma and, you know, the Carolinas. So I know you're also a multifamily guy. So what are you investing in right now in terms of multifamily assets?
So in multifamily, the reason we're in multifamily is that because we make all the money in the land, and land, the one downside of land is that it doesn't cash flow, right? So what we do is we flip land. So we put it under contract for cheap and immediately mark it up and sell it to somebody else. Or we do the land, we put it under contract, then sell it up, with mark it up to almost market value, sell it with seller financing and get cash flow for land. But even that cash flow, if somebody pays off the piece of land to you in monthly payments, so you have a property, it's worth $100,000, you put it under contract, or $50,000, you put it under contract for 10, sell it for 50 with a $10,000 down payment, Now you get $500 a month in cash flow, but only for, what, 10 or 12 years, and then the cash flow ends. So ultimately, we're looking at, Michelle and I again looked at each other and says, like, you know what? We want to build income that lasts a lifetime. And these notes are fantastic because you get cash flow from then, but they stop. If you have a five-year note, after 5 years, it stops. 7 years, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, 18 years. The most they typically go is like 18 to 20 years, which is a great stability. But in 18 years, I'm 61 or I'm 71. I don't want to have to rebuild my cash flow stream at that point. So that's what drove us to say, you know what? We need to take the money we made with land, quick flips, wholesaling, land seller financing, and we need to roll that into other asset classes. And the asset class we chose is multifamily, simply as you do too, because office went down the drain in the last few years because, well, people work from home. Like Airbnb is like on shaky legs sometimes in certain markets because there's too much competition. Every asset class, retail is being challenged by Amazon and so on and so forth. But people, we're still a growing country. United States has a population growth. People need to live somewhere. So that's basically simply from a decision point of like, where's the lowest risk? And where's the highest stability for long-term ownership? And that's multifamily. So yep. In multifamily, what we focus on is on the smaller multifamily, meaning about 70 to 150 units or small to mid-size in that end, typically between like $5 and $20 million in purchase price, class C and B usually. But in the early days, we did deals all over the, we did deals in Oklahoma City and we did deals in Louisiana, things like that. We have left all of those markets. We have one deal left in Louisiana that we're looking to sell later on this year. But other than that, we have actually focused mainly on the markets that have a 40, 50 year growth history, meaning Arizona, Phoenix, Dallas, Fort Worth, and to some degree, Tampa, Florida, even though Tampa has a problem with property taxes, not with property taxes, with insurance going through the roof and being very unpredictable right now. So we're kind of put a hold on Tampa, and we have 91 units under contract right now in Fort Worth. It's a distressed deal, came from the bank. The owners had almost $14 million into it. We're buying it for $9.75 million. It's a 7.5 cap at purchase price. It still has some upside. It's a great C-plus property in a B kind of area. And it's affordable rent and so on. It's a fantastic deal. And we're looking actively also in the Phoenix area because the beauty about Phoenix is that it gets 70,000, and Dallas too, they get 70,000 people a year moving there, have been getting that for the last 40 years. It's not going to stop anytime soon. And there's very few natural catastrophes in those both markets. Particularly Phoenix has nothing. I mean, you have assets in Phoenix, so it has nothing. There's no earthquakes, there's no tornadoes, there's no hurricanes. There's none of that stuff. There's just heat and you have air conditioning against that. So as a result, the cost of operating properties in those markets is very low. The growth factor is very high and it just makes for a really, really good market to operate in.
You mentioned that deal in Fort Worth, but how have you seen the interest rate environment affect your acquisition portfolio in the last sort of 12 to 18 months with the run-up in interest rates? And were you buying pre-run-up in interest rates?
We were buying pre-run-up in interest rate, but something in my gut told me that this is a party that looks like it's too good to be true. So we did not buy really anything in Phoenix or Dallas, Fort Worth during the run-up of the prices and when cap rates were like really super low and prices were outrageous. And I'm glad we didn't because we just kept underwriting extremely conservatively and therefore pricing ourselves out of all the deals. But now I'm very, very happy we did that because a lot of the people that did buy in the last 2 years are losing their shirt right now. And so that puts us in a position of actually being able to buy right now. And we're still underwriting very conservative. I don't think interest rates are going to be back in the 4-5% range in the next 2-3 years. I think it's going to take longer. We've been in real estate now 22 years. We've seen like the big, like if you look at what happens in 2008, 9, 10, the big crash in real estate. Real estate didn't come back up 3-4 years later. It took 10 years for it to come back up, come back up and get into that next area of frenzy. So that next area of big frenzy and low interest rates and things, in my estimation, is 10 years from now. So we're buying such that we can, that the numbers work in an interest rate environment between 5.5% and 6%. We're buying where the cap rates are significantly higher than they have been in the last few years. And if the deal makes sense in that environment, we're buying. So I don't think a 7.5 cap rate in Dallas, Fort Worth is something that will stay. I think Dallas, Fort Worth, with its population growth and all those things, should be a market that should be in the 5 cap rates, right? So 5, 5.5, 6 perhaps on a C-class property. So we're underwriting this as an exit at a 6 cap. And 5 years from now, which I think is a very safe underwriting, because in 5 years from now, there's going to be a shortage of properties again. Because right now, nobody's breaking ground on brand new properties right now. People that have broken ground are finishing their properties, but nobody is building new product right now and goes to the permitting process right now because the environment is just not set for it. Well, that means that a lot of properties going to come on the market in the next 18 months. So rents are not going to grow in many of these markets, even the top markets in the next 18 months. But in about 24 to 36 months, when all of the inventory has been absorbed, at that moment, we're going to have a shortage again because nobody broke ground.
Yep, I agree.
And if you're in those top markets, then rents are going to go up again and cap rates are going to go down again. So we're estimating 5 to 7 years holding times. And in those 5 to 7 years holding times, I think we're well positioned for a really positive exit. And we bought nothing last year, for example, but we bought two assets in December of 2022. And those also with a 5 to 7 year holding horizon in the Phoenix and in Tampa. So markets that over the next seven years, the same thing is going to happen in those markets. So we're just very, very careful in what we buy, very, very careful in how we underwrite. We never take two-year bridge loans. We always take long-term loans. And as a result, we have been able to cruise through the market conditions that we have. And our investors getting returns, and our investors have a very positive outlook on their investments.
That's great. No, I appreciate you. I was going to ask you what type of debt you're putting on it. So I assume it's all agency debt, fixed rate stuff right now?
Yeah, we have never been the kind of operators that go and buy some really heavy lift to caudal repositioning kind of assets. So when you have everything original and you have like a two-year horizon where you kick everyone out and completely rebuild, that's not our model. Our model is something that we can get agency debt on that is already 90% occupied, and where we can now take over the next 2-3 years and go remodel 30 to 50% of the units. And we're doing just upon turn, and we're keeping the occupancy high. That means cash flow continues to come in. And for that, so yes, we're looking to get agency debt with at least a 7-year term, usually, if not 10 plus years.
Well, Jack, you've been an absolute wealth of knowledge, my friend. At the end of every show, we love to dive in the top 5 investing tips. You ready to get into it?
Let's go.
Mate, question number one, what's a daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
Daily habit that I do is, I actually do very few of those. I'm not one of these guys that have a religious morning habit. If anything, it's dinner with the family together. We make it for sure that we get the family together every evening and we sit together and we instill that in our daughter that she eats breakfast on her own before she goes. She's 16 already. We have lunch wherever we have lunch. But dinner, everyone is back together and we have that time together as a family. We make it, so it's not a morning routine, it's more like an evening routine, because in the evening, everyone is together. And it's like that debriefing that we sit together on my daughter's bed and we chat about the day, or she comes over to us. And we just make it a point to have that, let's say 20 minutes every day that we just as a family connect and really talk about what's important in our lives.
I love it. Question number two is, who's been the most influential person in your career to date?
It's probably my wife, Michelle, because actually she came from Honduras, and probably the one thing that really helped us have a strong belief system in real estate is the fact that her dad, who passed away when she was 9 months old, just 2 years before she passed away, he had some land that he had in Honduras. He sold the land and he bought one commercial building with that. And he was able to buy that small commercial building. I was able to buy that free and clear, and that commercial building provided for her to go to high school, to school, to middle school, and even to college in the United States, a cheap state college, but still to college in the United States. And if there's ever been a definition of passive income, then that's probably it. Because, I mean, how much more passive can it get when the person that actually bought the asset doesn't even live anymore, and for the next 21 years, they can still provide for the family with their act and their investment activities while they were alive. So that got us a really true factor of deeply believing in real estate. And that probably is responsible for us being able to go through all these failures that I mentioned and still move ahead, because we knew there's something in real estate that we can make work.
Love it. Question number three is, what's the most influential tool in your business? When I say tool, it could be a physical tool like a phone or a journal, or it's a piece of software that you can't run the business without. What is it?
So in our business, we created the software for the land flipping business, a piece of software called Investment Dominator that has that end-to-end deal structure. It has a buying software, a buying website, a selling website, deal analysis, offer analyzer, even loan servicing can be done through it. It's integrated with a data service. It's integrated with a mailing house. It's integrated with has task management, has calendar management. It's a full-blown thing that we allow our students to use too. I couldn't imagine doing our land business without that tool.
Awesome. That's awesome that you've been able to create that from scratch. Question number four is, in one sentence, what's been the biggest failure in your career? What'd you learn from that failure?
I pride myself to be an eternally positive person. So failure, I have almost memory loss of failures, because it's like the quarterback. You fail and you have to get back up. And 30 seconds later, you have to play another against the same kind of people that just beat the living hell out of you, right? And just crushed you. So you have to have a very, very short memory. And it's said in sport, the one with the shortest memory is the best quarterback. And failures are incredibly important. So for example, the failures that I would think one of these first kind of deals that didn't work, where we failed getting like that wholesale deal sold, or failed to get that fix and flip going, or a failure was one time we sent letters, 900 letters to Sonoma County, Arizona, Sonoma County, California, to get deals on, not considering that Sonoma County is one of the most attractive wine areas in the country. I didn't drink much wine back then, and not that I drink much now, but now I drink Sonoma wine and Napa wine. But back then it was more like I realized that it was the wrong area to go after, because there was almost nobody in that area willing to let their property go for pennies on the dollar, because they understood that each acre is worth $1 million and can be sold, can be used for wine growing. And so everyone, people are declared us crazy. So what we learned from that is that while the United States is 3,007 counties, there's probably a couple hundred counties where this doesn't work very well, because it's a situation like that or the exact opposite situation. So it taught us to be very much more critical about that. The county selection and the area selection, where do you do this in the United States, is one of the most critical things to learn.
Love it. No, great stuff. Mate, last question. Where can people reach you to continue the conversation that will be in your sphere? Where do they go?
All right. So if you want to learn more about the land flipping, for example, you simply go to Land Profit Fun. Now, fun is like having fun, F-U-N. So landprofitfun.com. And you can get, you can download like a 30-day blueprint of exactly how this works. And if you're interested in talking to us about multifamily, you can go to orbitinvestments.com. So Orbit, O-R-B-I-T, investments.com. And you can find out more about that. But for the land kind of stuff, it's landprofitfun.com. Again, there's a whole bunch of free resources, or my podcast, or my YouTube channel, Jack Bosch. There's all, or in social media, we have now 300,000 followers. So you can go to Instagram, Facebook. I'm all over the place. Jack Bosch, and I'll pop up.
Awesome, brother. Well, look, mate, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day. I just want to reflect some of the things that I took away from today's show, is that you really have a tenacity for going out and figuring it out. Like, even from your early story when you were young, coming to the United States, wanting those three things, be able to learn English better and be able to, you know, get an education, and then be able to sort of propel yourself into the corporate world. And then being able to identify opportunities as you fail forward. You know, you were looking at the fix and flip, that didn't work. You failed to the next thing. And then you finally found a niche that worked for yourself. And I think that's a really key thing for so many investors starting out there, that it's not the first thing that you pick up that will send you to the moon. It might be the third, fourth, fifth, 10th thing, but you've got to have the tenacity to keep going. So really, really appreciate that. Did I leave anything out that, you know, you spoke for an awesome period of time, but did I leave anything out?
No, I think that's a great summary. Yes.
Awesome, brother.
I think you're right. I compare myself sometimes to a bulldog. Once I bite, I don't let go. And basically, it's whatever it's going to take, however long it's going to take, whatever it takes, we ultimately got to figure it out. And that's what you picked it right out very, very well.
Yeah. Well, look, again, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to jump on this show. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll catch up very, very soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
We there have another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible advice from Jack. Remember, it's Jack Bosch, all over social media. You can check it out at www.landprofitfund.com, or you can go over to orbitinvestments.com as well if you're on the multifamily side. I want to thank you all for taking some time out of your day to tune in to continue to grow your financial IQ, because that's what we're about here on this show. The easiest way to give back is to give it a 5-star review on iTunes. All the show notes from today's show will be up on my website at reedgoossens.com, and we're going to do this all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.